As a friend of mine said, he says, I got my theology at Oberlin, but I got my Negroology in Alabama. the point being is that there is no style, no training, no program that in fact fits the kind of environment, situation, difficulties that we have within that which is so different in fact from average American culture. So that many of the institutions' training programs in fact separate, and there must be new kinds of training situations, which I would give, of course, my own anti-seminary as a good example. Then the sixth thing, of course I would, you know, I'm after that $2.5 million, I saw my friend chuckling back there. A sixth point is that we have to change the numbers game. Just that simple. We have to change the numbers game. We have been so long bragging about, we've got a kid from our church. This is what poor church style. We've got a kid from our church that we're sending off to college, and aren't we great? 9 times out of 10, it was a $100 scholarship. it just about got him to the school. Now, is that we have to change the numbers game. Is that when we begin to look at the picture we talk about in terms of the program in Alabama, that was fine. Everybody would say, isn't that nice, 107 kids in college. The need is for something like 1,000 or 2,000 per state per year. If in fact we're serious about the matter of creating new communities, staffing new institutions, and developing what it takes to make it possible for some 40 million black and poor people in this nation to be independent instead of charity wards of one type or the other. We have to change that numbers game. And what this is going to mean possibly is a new kind of thing. Means not only do we need about 1 million teachers and 750,000 programmers, another 1 million preachers, but then it also means, you think we can stand another 1 million preachers down? It's also going to mean that we're going to have to look at some particular institutions and co-opt them. A strategy that in fact does this. A few of the Irish made it one way, but most of them made it in the steel industry. A few Jews made it with banking, but most of them made it as amalgamated clothing workers. Point being is that there must be some grand strategy for changing a game whereby that you can think in terms of hundreds of thousands of people being employed and being in control of that employment process. So that we must have strategies that take the negatives and make them positives. Bevel and I were talking the other day. Jim Bevel, if you don't know the name, why, you will sooner or later. Jim Bevel is the best organizer we got, and one of those kind of guys that is always thinking. Anyway, Jim Bevel and I were setting the house the other night. We were talking about the matter that we have the tremendous advantage in the fact that we're unemployed. You see, if you're rich, you call it leisure. But if you've been brainwashed, you call it unemployment. And you're so sorry that you have all that time on your hands that you do nothing with it. But if you are rich enough to call it leisure, then you read Plato, and out of this leisure, you create new worlds. Now, it's about time for us to take this unemployment and turn it into leisure and create some new black bases. For instance, to take that negative and make it a positive, real strategy development in fact, but when we begin to look in terms of the numbers game, in terms of where we're going, we see the need for some 3 million programmers by 1975. Even the popular magazines tell us that. That's where I got it. I didn't really get it from the statistical chart. Now, it is up to us to set up the kind of institutions in the ghetto get the kind of input that we need, that while other kids who are lucky enough to have jobs are working away on jobs that won't even be here by 1975, and we will have developed and taken over at least a field that is going to be basic to the whole new automated world. And when we get it, to unionize it so we control it. You hear that? See, because what is happening now, the training programs made by us, made for us by white people, are for bricklaying and things that won't even be here in 10 years. My youngest son is going to one day ask me, "Daddy, what's a brick?" Now, when we begin to look at it, he's already asked me, "What is crackling bread?" But there must be the fact of changing the numbers game so that we in fact begin to deal with the reality that by 1970, one or two, what makes the difference, the population is going to, well, by 25, the population is going to be doubled. 8 out of every 10 people in this nation is going to live in a population strip. We must deal with the reality that given just 15 more years to 20 years, that population is going to be doubled again. And that when we think we got to think in terms of a numbers game, or in fact the talk of community, will not be real. The strategy will be short term, will not deal with the kind of needs that make men independent in the midst of a power block culture. Now, this leads to then a most important 7th guideline, is that decision-making must be by common folk. Decision-making must be by common folk. Those who hurt the worst think the best about their situation. Part of the charity game is to make decisions for other people so they can say, "Oh, aren't you bright and good and wonderful?" And in the back of your mind, you can make yourself feel like one of the saints that we hang on the wall. And that our main concern is just that. To be able to say to people how we are guiding them. Part of the charity game. And that if decisions are to be made, they must be made by common folk. And common folk have a right to make mistakes. I was in Syracuse, New York last week or week before went out to the Council of Churches building. Here was the Council of Churches, all the grains of the Protestant church within that city, had money to build a $1 million building, had architects to come in, and you haven't seen such a monstrosity in your life. We have a right to make mistakes, but poor people don't have a right to make mistakes. We're going to tell them what they need and what they want on our terms. The time is gone for that. The problem with the programs of Detroit and Chicago that have been handed down from Washington, I'm not saying this in a regular context, but which have been put together in Detroit and Chicago by people who were not suffering and people that didn't have to live with or in the kind of programs that they were dealing with. So in Chicago, you can go down State Street for 5.5 miles of 20-story apartment buildings. Well, there's nothing wrong with 20-story apartment buildings. They've got 20-story apartment buildings on the North Shore, and the apartments cost $300 to $500 a piece. Problem being is 20-story apartments, where we know them on the South Side, is the apartments are very, very small. There are, the average age of that was 13 years old, or no, it's less than that, 11 years, 12. It's between 11 and 13. And I'm glad we were close, however. The average age there says something completely different. But the people who had to live there didn't have a chance to make the decision. And the slow-moving elevators with all those 11 and under kids waiting until the last minute before they go to upstairs said, in fact, that every elevator smells like urine. And poor people get blamed for stamping out the grass and having urine-smelling elevators when it goes back to the fact that those that planned it did not respect the personalities of the people who had to live there. And they built for money, not for men. They were concerned about balance, not dignity. And that as we begin to think that people themselves know their situation best, and that we, with our money and expertise, must realize that poor people, black people, need money and they need expertise, but they do not need decision makers. And that our role is to supply the resources, but not to make the final decisions for other people's lives. That's plain God. And since we want some sort of little theological input, why, we can call it breaking the first commandment. Basically, we're talking about good sense. So that when we begin to see that we must begin to see that conditions in community should be decided by the people that have to live there. Done with experts, not by experts. And that those that suffer in a condition and have to live there are those that should make the decisions, and they should have as much time as they need to do it, and that they should have a chance to make mistakes. Finally, you've been waiting for this. Finally, is that right now the priority is to develop an economic base for black people and poor people. That the failure to develop an economic base will in fact mean more charity and no independence. If we do not really see that the name of the game is money, that the name of the game at a higher level is dignity. But as Jesse Jackson says, that a man who is in capitalism without capital can really forget being treated with dignity. And in a society as brutal as ours, will see his dignity destroyed. And that we must be about the business of developing an economic base. I had one of the shocks of my life when I found that a number of the major foundations of this country got together in a long conference to decide whether they should give money to organizations that would end up making money. They could give $9 million to a study, but decided not to give money to any organization that would allow people to make money. But if you can't make money, you don't become independent. And if we do not develop strategies that in fact do this, we're talking nonsense. And that the denial to deal realistically with that, an economic base, will make the rest of it nonsense, and you and I will still be doing therapy, talking about how good we are, how loving and just we are. Then we'll be playing Mickey Mouse. That's the realism.
Well, I must begin by saying that I deeply regret that while I was at the Urban Training Center this last summer, Reverend Vivian was on vacation, and I did not have the opportunity to share of the wisdom which he brought to us this evening. He is a good representation of the type of instructor and teacher and enabler that the Urban Training Center provides for those who do attend. So that if you should ever be there, you would find that there are many more men just as capable as Pastor Vivian. It's rather unusual and uncomfortable for for me to be on this end of the table after just a few months being over here with the experts, I suppose you might say. I can't help but remembering an interpretation of the word expert I once heard. When something like this, an X is a has-been, the spurt is a drip under pressure. I think that we should realize that today, in the face of the crisis that we are looking at, that in facing the report which recently came out by the President's Commission on the Civil Disorders, that there are no experts. There are no real answers to any of us, for any of us. That we're all groping together, trying to find where we might fit ourselves as servants of our Lord together in a common ministry to help our country and the many people within our country to realize the real gospel. I suppose that being asked to speak about the Urban Training Center is because I am somewhat of an oddity. While at the Urban Training Center, there was also another oddity, the first Southern Baptist ever to attend this center. I found that we were considered to be in very much the same boat, being from the Missouri Synod. And so this was a rather interesting bedfellow that I had. But it was good. Because we suddenly found ourselves thrown together with a number of other concerned people from many other denominations and church bodies, some more common, some not so common, but men struggling together over a common problem, trying to come up with some answers for this problem. When we speak of the Urban Training Center, I suppose most of us think of it in terms of the plunge experience. This seems to be the most common, commonly referred to aspect of the UTC program. And of course, the program begins with, at the end of the first week, a plunge where we are sent out on Skid Row with something like $6 in your pocket to last you for 4 days and three nights. And you naturally find yourselves in some rather interesting experiences making do with that amount of money. I remember that first day out, I was really going to play it smart, and I was going to buy some food supplies in rather large quantity so that I wouldn't have to, you buy it cheaper, you buy it in quantity. So I went out and bought in quantity, only to discover that while I was taking a nap later in the afternoon, someone came along and walked off with it. So that I was without. And I learned what it was like to collect pop bottles and turn them in at the store for 2 cents apiece. It was a rather interesting experience because you find you can only hold so many pop bottles at one time. And you find that maybe the safest place to sleep at night, where even the police won't bother you, is in a cemetery. It seems to bother all sorts of other people. And it's nice and quiet there, too. Maybe the most interesting thing was when I was out and sitting on the doorstep of a vacated store up in a white Appalachian area. I've been sitting there for a good hour because I was kind of tired from all that walking. And several small children, about 5, 6, 7, and another one about 8 or 9, were running back and forth. And at one time they stopped and they looked down at me and says, "How come you're still there?" And I explained to them that I was tired and I was simply resting there. And then the one little fella looked to the other fella and said, "You know something? He loves you." And of course, in the embarrassment of the moment, they quickly ran off. But during this whole plunge experience, that was probably the one time that I really experienced acceptance by another human being. Then, of course, it happens that while we were out on the plunge, Chicago had to pick that weekend to have the 4-inch rain that fell within 1 hour. And this was a rather interesting experience. And that evening we went to stay out of the rain, we went to one of these all-night movies, which also happened to be a homosexual hangout in the city. And we found that the ushers every 15 minutes would come through and wake up everyone so that you got more sleeping in a cemetery than you did in an all-night theater. Well, the program at UTC did some very unusual things because out of this rather conservative Missouri Synod Lutheran, it created such a situation that I blew my mind no less than twice during the summer. And that was a sight to behold. The Urban Training Center is made up of a wide variety of experiences put together in such a way so that about the time you're becoming tired of one form of communication, the program switches over to another type of communication, and your attention is caught and held there. And when that begins to die, we switch it to another scene. And so that by the end of the day, you find that after 8 to 10 hours of simply listening, you're just utterly exhausted because you've had your attention caught and held so much of the time. And that after 7 days a week of this, for 4 weeks, you found the information coming in to such an extent that it completely washed over you, and after about the third week, you were like a sponge that was full of water and could hold no more, and yet the stream of water was going by. You weren't shocked at anything anymore. You simply kind of looked at it with a bleary-eyed, mystic attitude, not sure what was happening, but scribbling down words and sentences and thoughts, hoping that later on they would make some sort of relevance to you, have some sort of meaning. Well, afterwards, I might explain that the Urban Training Program was set up in such a way that you had the 1 month intensive program of presentations by the staff and by a very large number of outside guest speakers, and then after that, you spend your time, if you're in the three-month program, you spend the remaining 2 months involved in a fieldwork experience where you are actually out with an agency of some type working under the direction of that agency in the community. Well, at the end of our first month, we all sat back and tried to begin sorting out all that had happened to us. And gradually we began to hang a few things on a few hooks. And I suppose the one framework that I found that I could place the whole experience of what happened at the Urban Training Center, the one reference, scene of reference that I could use was this, that the Urban Training Center was engaged in a conspiracy to make us listen. I did this in the very usual ways of using lectures and dialogues, and of getting men with opposing views up in front of the class at the same time and giving equal time, and then turning us loose on them. Of using the plunge experience when being on Skid Row for the first time for many of us, we were forced to listen to find out how to exist in that type of society, in that type of a culture, where we were forced to listen to others, and when there was no one else speaking, to listen to our own footsteps and our own heartbeats, and finally to begin listening a little bit to ourselves. Preceding the plunge experience, they sent us out on what they called a power plunge. This was a rather interesting phenomenon. A group of, I believe there were five or six of us in our group, were sent out to the suburb of Cicero. And Cicero has its repute from different areas. Al Capone happened to have lived there once. Also is known for its very strong anti-Negro attitude. And so our group was sent out, and in our group we had a nun who, for the first time in 16 years, was going incognito. And we had a Nigerian student who spoke his English with a rather broken accent. And about three or four others of us from various church groups from across the country. And here we were, very anxiously watching every car that went by, making sure that no one pulled a submachine gun on us, because here we were with a Nigerian in the middle of Cicero. And we were sent out there, very interestingly, with the question. You are to go out there and find out why is it that the police force is very harsh upon small violations, such as traffic tickets and violations of this type, and yet has its eyes hidden to the prostitution racket and the gambling racket and the various other major corruptions that go on. Well, of course, the answer is that there's some very high power involved here that's behind the police force, seeing that it does crack down on this small violator but doesn't disturb the big-time gambling syndicate and the prostitution racket. And so here we were, this motley group, wandering around in Cicero, asking people questions why their police force was only... Fortunately, there was the township out there had a junior college, and they had a sociology department. And the sociologist on the job was a pretty sharp fella. Otherwise, we may never have come back. But again, we were forced to listen and to find out where to listen. And to find out that you don't get very far by asking a policeman about this sort of thing. And that you have to determine where your sources of information are. Later, when we got back to the Urban Training Center, we separated into small groups where we could discuss amongst ourselves what had happened. And in a sense, these were very similar to the groups that you have going here now on campus, which just last year, I believe, had its initial beginning. And where you had us talking together with one another, discussing what had happened to us, what we had found out about ourselves and about others, of asking the question of who we really were when we were out on that plunge. Were we really, in my case, Mike Wendt, with a stubble and blue jeans and a torn shirt? Or was I someone else? Was I really able to identify with that individual on Skid Row? And we struggle over these questions, trying to determine just who we were, and asking ourselves just how much did we listen, and what did we listen for? Or maybe were we even listening at all? And these small groups continued throughout the duration of the summer for all 3 months, even after we got into the fieldwork program, so that we were continually coming back together and reflecting again amongst one another upon what we were doing and upon how well we were listening and upon the strategies we were developing, which depended upon how well we listened. While there, we had the opportunity to attend the IRC, or the Industrial Relations Center of the University of Chicago. And here we went through a four-day session of, it was called by a very bland thing, how to conduct a meeting. Well, this was all right until you got into it. You were told that after the first 2 hours, you could decide whether you wanted to continue or not. If you want to continue, you had to go all the way through with it. And this made us, you know, a little suspicious. Well, what is this? So when we got out there, we found out that being involved with this program meant that each of us, after we learned what the basic types of meetings were, led one of each of those types of meetings in the group with the rest of the others listening and being the committee that you were meeting with. Again, we were forced to listen to others and to ourselves as we, after each meeting, discussed what had happened and discussed our role, not only as leader, but also as interrelator, as one of the members of that meeting. At another time, we had the opportunity to attend the AT&T building. And the technicians there gave us the whole package program that they normally give to businessmen. They told us that it ran something like $250 a head per day for the program. I'm not sure how you fellas worked that, but it was a real sharp deal that we got in. You have friends. And there we were shown the whole mass of computers. Some of these were so new that they were not even on the market yet. And we were shown how, by just dialing the telephone number, you could tell, you would connect into a computer. And by having the proper machine in your office, you could type out the question, and the computer would type back it would send back the answer, and it would be typed out there for you. And to see how these computer grids were hooked together across the country. And we looked at system analysis. And incidentally, I was down at 210 here several days ago and asked them about system analysis and how it could possibly be used in working with an inner city center of the type we have in Jacksonville. And they were kind of shocked that we were asking such questions. But we saw this in action, a type of business sociology where you look at the processes involved of how the information flows through an organization, of how the power flows, of how it changes, and the ways in which it works, and how you can construct it so that it becomes a more efficient and effective system to do what you actually want it to do. And again, here we were spent the whole day listening and watching them as they would roll out a computer out of a The wall would slide up and a computer would roll out. And they would show us what was the computer, and they would use it for us and demonstrate on it. And then they would roll back, and another wall would slide up, and another type of computer would come out. You know, after a while, you just got dizzy just watching the wall slide up and the computers roll out. Okay, after this, after we learned to listen, we began talking a little bit about how we begin to use what we've heard in terms of developing strategies to change the structures. We might add that this month that we were there, the entire emphasis was on power. Power in terms of the political community, in terms of the religious community, power in terms of economic power, of power of culture as it wields it over against subcultures, power in almost any aspect that you could think of the use of power. So that we began thinking out how we could use this power in terms of very specific strategies of action. And we did this in our fieldwork situations. I was, I might add that we are given the, in fact, we're almost forced to choose our own situation, our own agency we're going to work with. And I chose to work with the Northwest Lutheran Parish, which is an American Lutheran Church parish of 13 congregations on the near north side of Chicago, which is working together to try and develop some sort of corporate ministry between some inner city parishes, some Spanish American parishes, and a number of middle class parishes. Well, they in turn loaned me out to the LSNA, which being interpreted is the Logan Square Neighborhood Association, a neighborhood association which was dominated by the business interest of the community in Logan Square, the Logan Square neighborhood. About this time, four of us moved from the near the Urban Training Center into an Italian neighborhood, and I began my work of organizing block clubs in a Polish neighborhood. This was rather interesting since I know neither Italian nor Polish. Yet, in working with these people, in talking to them, in helping them to become sensitized to their own problems, they began to see the need that, well, as you mentioned, one man alone doesn't do the job. You've got to get people together, working together, so that you develop power. And so these people began to meet together in a form of block club. They began to relate to one another in terms of how they can tackle the immediate problem. And in this case, the immediate problem was a building which had been burned out and which the owner was insisting on maintaining as a low rental housing project. And they were fighting against this. It's rather interesting that by the end of the summer, this group of people that were beginning to work together had come to the conclusion that they no longer needed LSNA to represent them, that they were going to do it on their own, and they were going to do it with their own resources. In this case, it happened that they had a policeman involved with their program, but that they were concerned enough that they did not want to be under the paternalistic hand of the business community, which was funding LSNA in the community. I thought that was a very interesting outcome to the way this particular group worked. Well, now, as far as my Jacksonville situation goes, I was called to Jacksonville to serve as the coordinator, the sensitizer, the enabler, the fellow that puts the burr under the saddle of our six Lutheran congregations there. Five of these congregations are white, are if anything, lower middle class or lower. The sixth congregation is a very typical middle to upper middle class Negro congregation, but has a very unusual aspect to it in that it is one of the rare middle class Negro congregations that I've seen where the members, the people, are willing to turn around and to stretch the hand back down to their brothers in the ghetto in the sense of being really concerned about their problems and being willing to put their bodies on the line. Because this Negro parish was vacant, I was asked also to serve the vacancy there. So that my role there has been working with these six congregations in an attempt to sensitize the people, to sensitize them to the urgency of that which was brought out in the commission's report just several weeks ago, to sensitize them to the fact that they, as whites and as blacks, must begin working now in very critical areas, that they must become involved in very extensive ways, working with the power structures that exist, working with the agencies that do exist in the community and which are carrying on ministries of some sort or another. But maybe more than anything, to go out and begin working with those people who are right now alienated from the rest of our society. And to begin working with them with a sense of urgency that the time is growing short when we as white people will be able to effectively work in the Negro community. And to work with our Negro people, spouting out black power from my white mouth, so that when the time comes that they must pick up the ball, when they are forced to, that they may be a little bit better prepared to do this. Sensitizing them in the realization that regardless of what the future holds, that we are still all Christians in Christ, working together towards the one goal of a common humanity as our Lord's servants.